Welcome back, listeners, to another episode of Panoramic Outdoors. We've officially broken 30 podcasts. That's legit. And today we sit down with a eminent advocate for public lands in the U.S. and now branching out into Canada. But before we get into that, it's Chase and I here today. Sheldon is unfortunately still working his butt off with hydro.
Yeah, there's still tons of people without power out there, and sounds like they're still giving or still trying to fix up the grid for everybody. So,
Shelly, that warrants a double shout out to you and all the hydro boys and girls just busting their ass around the clock to get the power back to Manitobans.
Yeah, you guys are making it into two podcast episodes. That's how long the power, that's the amount of damage that's been done to the grid, essentially.
Good news is we got power here to record our podcast. And yep. That helps. Chase, what have you been up to this last little while here?
I will say this, and if you haven't tuned into our social media at all, this might be news to you, but I'm sure by the time this releases, this will be out on the gram. There's been a change of events in my archery bow saga.
Not me, man.
And I'm now the owner of a Matthews Traverse.
How did that happen?
there were some
sourcing issues
with the PSE,
because you got long ass gorilla arms.
Yeah, and there was some
how long is your draw length?
I got the Traverse set to 32 and a half now.
That is egregious.
Which is also, I'll dive into this a little bit. So kind of what happened, there's some sourcing issues, some variables in place that was essentially out of everybody's control. And I still wanted to get into the deer blind a couple times with the bow this year. So I ended up going down to Heights Archery and kind of gave them the spiel. Let's get a couple bows out and let's shoot. And I want to see what's what. So he brought out Matthews Traverse. It was the first bow he gave me. And he said, this will probably be the last bow you shoot, essentially.
Why do you say that?
Obviously they've had that bow in stock for a while, or that model. And he just said it's phenomenal. It's one of the smoothest bows. The vibration on it is so minimal. It's incredible. Just an incredible bow to shoot. And Ron there at Heights was telling me that guys often come in and because I have a Hoyt. Shot a Hoyt prior to, and he said they'll try out the Hoyts and they'll quite often leave with the Matthews.
Interesting.
So
has he tried a 83 PSE Stingray?
Clearly not.
I guess not, eh?
But I did put the Matthews up against the PSE. And, you know, putting them side by side, the Matthews did win out. And it having that extra half-inch draw length actually made a bit of a comfort difference for me, I found. So I do have to say, if I didn't go in there and shoot the Matthews, I'd probably be preaching about the PSE all day because it's still a fantastic bow.
Right.
But
Matthews closed the deal.
Yeah, it did.
What kind of kinetic energy is that then? Like, you're probably shooting, what, like a 56-inch arrow or something ridiculous like that?
It's a 32.5-inch arrow, 300 spine. They hooked me up with some gold tip hunters.
So you're going to be punching pass-throughs on cows basically here.
I think so. Should be. I haven't looked into the kinetics on it and stuff like that yet, but I'm interested. I'm hopefully going to whip the chrono out here soon and try it out. Haven't dialed it all in yet either. So
do a little radar.
Yeah.
Cool.
What about you?
Well, I think last we left off, I was in my fuck it all mode and I said, screw it, I'm going hunting this weekend. Damn be the consequences. Friday fell through, but that was kind of good because I got to relax and get some stuff done around the house. But more importantly, Saturday, I went out bird hunting with our good buddy there, Tyler. And you know what? This time of year, we normally think that the northern mallards are going to be in and hitting some of our holes. They were in. They just weren't necessarily going to the holes. So we didn't land up shooting a bunch until right at dark when we'd started just cleaning up. You know, the couple flocks that did come in turned into clockwork. At first, I thought we were just like awful hunters. But then those birds started to decoy and like slide in, and that worked out really well.
Nice. That's good.
And then on the Sunday, it was really cool because I went out with Graham from Point Proven.
That's right.
Yeah, I'm trying to hook into dogs with him, and I just wanted to see the dogs work, really.
Man, I'm actually like, that's one thing I on my list to do is go out and go for a hunt with him, because
yeah, it was awesome. Yeah. So, but like classic bad luck that transposed from Saturday to Sunday. So I'm guessing I brought it with me, because when I went out with Graham, we went to an upland field that he has, and we saw some Sharpies, but instead of Sharpies, we landed up seeing like 3,000 mallards.
Jesus.
In this flooded oat field.
Wow.
And so the mallards are just driving these dogs kind of nuts in some circumstances. So it was kind of hard to like get them to focus, but also like the Sharpies, like where do the Sharpies hide in a flooded oat field, right?
Yeah, that's true.
So,
but you found the mallards.
Found the mallards. And then we went on a bit of a grouse hunt too, so got the dogs work. And it was just really interesting to watch how they like basically run around in the bush for like half an hour while you walk a trail, and they don't stop running.
Yeah, that's amazing.
They're trying to point birds, right?
That's awesome.
Yeah, it was awesome. So I got that out of my system, and now I can like return to like actually caring about the rest of the world. Because I was in a dark place for a little while there.
Oh, man. You know what? I kind of felt like that about this whole bow situation. I had, I think Jody seen the state of my mental health and was just like full support of me going out and buying a bow that I can have in my hands and start shooting.
Yeah. It was a protective factor for the family, eh?
Yeah. That's what it came down to, essentially.
So on the episode today, who we got on?
Man, I was really excited about this one. If you guys don't know him, check him out on Instagram. Check out the website. Lantani is the CEO, I believe.
CEO.
Of Backcountry Hunters and Anglers. Backcountry Hunters and Anglers.
Yeah.
Let's get that right. And if you look them up, they're a massive conservation group throughout pretty much the entire United States, and they've broken ground into Canada now, and BC, Alberta, and the Yukon.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, they're seem to have a great message, and they're going strong with it. Their numbers are essentially doubling yearly,
which is remarkable,
which is unbelievable. He said they're up to 40,000 members, I think, yeah, or something like that.
They're rolling, they're cooking.
Yeah.
And we're talking about like engaged people too, right? So that makes a world
very
of difference.
Engaged, yeah. And they like drinking beer.
Yeah, they do have pint nights, eh? Yeah. So take a listen to the podcast here. We try to draw on Manitoba a little, and we try to draw on Land's experience in the States. We think there's parallels there, so definitely like keep an ear open for that. And if you have questions or comments about like what we can do in Manitoba to help preserve our public lands, like we'd be more than happy to hear that. So hope you guys enjoy the podcast. Again, don't forget to like, comment, subscribe. All those things help us. They help us drive the media and get our message out there. And we appreciate all the love on Instagram and through the website, all that.
And we just got a sneak peek of some of our gear that's coming up for Christmas.
Christmas gear!
That's all I'm going to tell you. Enjoy the podcast, guys.
Peace.
Okay, so we got Lantani on the line with us, CEO of Backcountry Hunters and Anglers. Yeah, you guys are you guys the, you could say, one of the fastest growing conservation groups in America now?
Yeah, I would say, I mean, I'm tired of North America, but you know, we've been doubling our membership every year for the last 6 years. Now, when you start at 1,000 members, that's pretty easy to do. But once you start getting into, you know, 17,000, like we're almost at 40,000 right now. So
wow.
We'll totally get a doubling this year, but you know, our ranks continue to rise, you know, and you know, a ton here in the States, but also north of the border.
That's awesome. So I kind of did a bit of reading, and you guys have been at, or Backcountry Hunters Anglers have been at, have been an established group for about 14 years now, right? And how did that outlook, you know, coming into that? Like, what kind of goals were you guys setting?
You know, I think, you know, so I mean, I don't know if you guys have been around a campfire late at night and solved the world's problems. And that's probably even like where some of the best ideas come. And so we had some folks that were sitting around a campfire in Oregon, and they were sitting around and, you know, kind of having a conversation like you do and looking at all the kind of groups that were out there, you know, and a lot of people doing good work, you know, the Elk Foundation, Wild Sheep Foundation, Ducks Unlimited, kind of the list goes on species-wise, and some of the, you know, more traditional kind of folks. But nobody was really focused on public lands and public waters. And so really from the onset, the idea was to make sure that you had access to public lands and waters, and then the fish and wildlife habitat when you get there. You know, and I think that that quality fish and wildlife habitat is such an important piece of this conversation, because, you know, we can have access to places that we really just don't. It's not a place where we want to go, you know, toss a line or chase a critter around. So that's kind of, you know, the impetus of the organization. You know, I would say that, you know, from the very beginning, there was very quality people around, you know, people that spent a ton of time outside, and then, you know, really had some of the skills to talk to kind of some of the public land managers. And so, to me, I think that's carried, you know, really, that's where we are today. And, you know, we continue to have, again, this huge growing membership, but, we have, you know, sophistication, I would say, from our sage elders. And then we have a, you know, a big component of youthful exuberance that they can learn from some of those sage kind of wisdom, and, you know, try to carry the ball forward.
Amazing. So you've kind of capitalized, you hit this nexus here of, you had a lot of expertise and knowledge in the room, but you also had passion and drive. So you took those and you applied it to a problem, which is how do we make sure we have high quality, accessible public lands? And you just
damn, dude, I'm getting you on the payroll. That was good synopsis.
Like, so what are some of the tangible action? Cause like, man, you're preaching to the choir here. I got to say, like, I think we're thumping our chests right now, and maybe we're around the proverbial campfire as well with you. but what are some of the tangible actions that we've seen come out of Backcountry Hunter and Anglers?
Sure. So, I mean, I can, you know, I think I'll talk about kind of it in a couple of ways. I think that, you know, the first thing is that, you know, we are more of an advocacy organization than anything else. And so really trying to amplify folks' voices, you know, whether that's at a local level or at a more kind of national level. And so trying to make it easy for people to get engaged, and then really provide, you know, that kind of megaphone for their voice. So that's ultimately what we do kind of day in and day out. I'd say that's our bread and butter. I'll talk about some wins there in a minute. I think the big thing that's kind of been a new thing here in the last year and a half, maybe 2 years, is that really our on-the-ground kind of game's gotten just crazy good. And so I describe that in two ways. First one is kind of like cleanup projects, whether that's, you know, cleaning up garbage or rolling up, you know, miles of old dilapidated fence that's, you know, bad for big game animals in particular, you know, doing riparian zone kind of plantings, kind of that boots on the ground, you know, like redoing like bridges, maybe gotten washed out, but really doing kind of hands-on stuff. And I'll give you an example of that. This last September, you know, all across North America, we challenged our folks to pick up, you know, trash when they were out on the landscape. And they ended up, you know, through events and then just individual efforts, they brought in over 600, you know, bags of trash. And like that to me is like pretty cool. It's not something that, again, that we've done much of. Go ahead.
No, I was just saying that's amazing. I was reinforcing that. So, go online, please.
Yeah. So, I think that's a big one. The other piece that we've really been doing that isn't kind of in that advocacy piece, it's more about kind of trying to bring more people to hunting and fishing, is really, some of our work to basically train kind of new hunters. And this is more like the 20 and 30 somethings, people that haven't grown up hunting and fishing and getting involved in the foodie movement. And they're like, man, I like growing my own vegetables, but I have no idea how to, catch or kill my own meat. And so, you kind of take them through that whole entire process. And so this is something that's happening again, both, south of the border and north of the border. We're also starting to do dinners. I grew up, in a family that ate wild game, but it was pretty much two ways. It was a steak or a burger. And there's, as I think wild game and just cooking probably in general is really taking leaps and bounds, I'd say, in the last 5 years, is that we're also kind of doing these wild game kind of cook-offs or kind of learning from chefs and techniques. And so those are two new things that I think have really started in the last couple of years. It's pretty awesome. That's outside the norm of what we do, but it's what our people want and what they're doing. And we tend to, we go where the noise is, and that's one of them.
That's awesome. You spit out a lot there. So I kind of I want to break it down a bit. On the show, we've talked about ourselves, just kind of how we use hunting and fishing as a real connection to our food, and we've had those very similar conversations around how important it is, how we've kind of evolved their cooking skill set too as well as a result of that. But what I'm hearing from backcountry here is that you do the high level policy advocacy, but you're also what I'm hearing is doing some on the ground restoration hands and kind of boots on the ground work for that, actually improving the habitat and the land there. And then you're also involved in this hunter training. Now, would that be the hunter collegiate model that I did a little bit of reading about online?
There's some of that, just for the college kids, which that program is absolutely blown up. We have got over 25 college campuses that we're in right now. And so that's a component of that piece. Tomorrow night here in Missoula, we're having a butchering clinic that is open to the public that we're doing, with the local fish, wildlife and parks kind of agency.
Right.
And so that's open to everybody, and so we've done that. And then we have this I hate this term, but it's called adult onset hunters. It sounds like you have a disease almost.
I want to have that disease though.
I know, right? Right. But it's like folks that again didn't grow up hunting, So we've done kind of these programs also, working with our state agencies in particular, to facilitate kind of, again, the folks that are a little bit maybe older than college age folks that are maybe being missed, so that, they have the opportunities to learn and then, hopefully get out and, experience what we all, kind of think is second nature, I guess.
So it just sounds like you got these radically accessible programs that are aimed at meeting people where they're at and giving them what they want, which is, how the heck do I hunt? How the hell do I cook? And how do I make it fun? Is that fair?
That's totally fair. And I think that again, I think I said this earlier, is we kind of go where the noise is. And I think you said that a little bit more articulate. Sure. But, when people, kind of want something and we see it work, we're going to try to scale that up a little bit. And I think both these are definitely part of that. And, it really being driven by our folks on the ground.
You got to tell me more about that, man, though, because we're living in a time here where membership association rates are just dropping. People aren't going to church anymore. They're not involved in the community clubs. Membership rates are dropping. But here you've come up with a model that is absolutely thriving on engagement and has participants who want to be there and want to do good for their community and for public land. What's the secret here? Let us in here.
I think there's, get to the advocacy part, which I think is a big part of it. And so I think, that'll be kind of the second piece here. But I think that, it's partly, this is kind of maybe kind of lame, but it's trying to put fun back into conservation,
Right.
I think that, models are very important models. And I think that, you know, those work for a long time, but if you're not shaking those things up, I think they get maybe tired and, you know, people aren't as enthused. And so, you know, I've talked about kind of some of those boots on the ground. I've talked about, you know, kind of our food stuff. You know, we're doing, you know, pint nights all over North America as well, where, you know, instead of like a sit down meeting where you're talking about Robert's Rules of Order, really, you know, and not to, again, I think there's a place for that. But getting people together to talk about the issues of the day, you know, over a beverage. And I think that's something that people have been doing since, you know, beer was invented. And so it's kind of putting some fun and also making it approachable, I would say.
So you've kind of provided an alternative avenue is what you've done there.
Yeah. You know, and like, you know, we're doing like storytelling events too. You know, storytelling's been around since that first campfire, you know, and they were back rubbing sticks together and, you know, they probably told a story about, you know, how they've been trying to, you know, make fire their entire lives and they finally did it. You know? It's like storytelling is this thing that is also very fun. I think, you know, we've been doing these nights that they're like 10-minute stories. And so you get up and you hear, you know, 8 stories in an hour and a half. And it's like, it's a fun evening, you know? And I think providing that kind of energy, you know, people I think are starved for it. You know, we're all living in this world of social media and memes and like these short conversations. And, you know, I think, you know, we've done a pretty good job at you know, on social media kind of creating a community. But I think people want to meet face to face and they want to meet like and have fun. And I think a lot of the things that, you know, have been around, which again have been tried and true, like you kind of know what you're getting when you go to those things. And I think we're trying to shake that up a little bit. And, you know, it's one of the reasons why I think we have a lot of energy. You know, I'm 44 years old and I'm one of the oldest people on staff. So I think we have like a youthful energy within just staff. You know, a little bit of a chip on our shoulder. And so there's some hunger there. Really want to make a difference, you know, for conservation. We haven't gotten jaded yet, you know, and I still reserve that right to do that someday.
That's just so refreshing for you to say that though, because it feels like that's kind of like the mission that we're trying to accomplish here, at least to some extent on our end. Like we're trying to use social media definitely as a springboard to get our message out there. Yep. But I mean, we're also involved in things like our friend Josh McFadden runs a meetup, for example, and that's all about bringing folks around the campfire to have like a conversation and experience around a meal. And like we're using a podcast to basically have a digital conversation on things that are important for hunters and fishers in Manitoba.
Yeah,
I think that the podcast, like, I love that you bring that up. Like, it's long form, right? And, like, we're having a conversation, you know, that people get to glean different things from versus, like, here's a snippet, you know, think this, you know, I appreciate, you know, the opportunity, one, to be on today, but that you recognize what a role that you're playing that way as well.
The big thing about the podcast, too, is, like, everybody is so freaking busy these days that it's, like, this is something that they can squeeze in from point A to point B very easily. So it's a good way for us to pass on a message where they don't have to be fully engaged and don't have to have their full attention essentially to get through to people.
Totally.
And, I just love your mindset on how you're getting people together, creating energy and essentially getting people around the campfire and, through different, paths of work and stuff like that. We've all often spoken about like what is the best way to get people kind of together, get their real truths out there and get them to enjoy themselves, but figure out real problems that happen either throughout the day or throughout the week or whatever. And we all often laugh about solving the world's problems around the campfire like you said. But to be honest with you, sitting around a campfire or having that pint night and having a pint is the best way to get people relaxed and the best way to get folks' true thoughts, I feel like, out there on the table so we can actually get down to like brass tacks and put some work into some of these issues.
That's well said. And I think that, you know, that brass tacks, and I've kind of talked about fun, kind of, you know, youthful energy. I think that at the end of the day, we are an advocacy organization. So we are trying to, again, make sure you have access to public lands and waters and fish and wildlife habitat when you get there. And so I think what's also unique about BHA, which, you know, I think has really led to the growth, is that we're willing to call it like we see it and, you know, really, you know, support folks that are doing good things for conservation, no matter what kind of background they have politically. And then, you know, when they do otherwise, we hold them accountable. And, you know, when we hold them accountable, they could have done something great the day before. Or vice versa, they did something bad the day before and then something great. Like we applaud, and then we spank. And I think that's a very honest relationship. I think that, you know, that it's refreshing in the world of, kind of sideways political speak. Like we try to do, you know, it's pretty easy when we make a decision on something. It's about, is that good for the resource or is it bad for the resource? Is that good for hunters and anglers or is that bad for hunters and anglers? And it's those two questions, and if they're pretty easy to answer, like it's easy for us to make decisions. And so, you know, you won't see us, politically speak about things, you know, like where you can tell somebody's kind of not saying exactly what they want to say, or you know, they decide to say things behind closed doors. Like we're very upfront and responsive to, you know, our grassroots, and I think that's in our nature, and I think that's one of the reasons why we've been successful in growth, but also, you know, getting stuff done.
Man, I don't want to blow too much smoke up you, but like I can see how that fits perfectly with kind of like getting the ball rolling at the pint and really getting the juices flowing and getting those ideas generated and the passion kind of stoked, and then transitioning it into like the kind of grind at the boardroom or grind at the table, but being just like radically honest and like authentic. Like I think people, like if you're tapping into their passions, they want truth at the end of that, right? They don't want, as you said, that political doublespeak, right? Like when I talk to hunters and anglers, they just want quality access to public land. You know what I mean? They don't really care how that comes about necessarily all the time, right?
So totally. I think it's a unifier too, right? Like, I mean, this world is like I'm on this side or I'm on that side kind of world. It seems like sometimes things seem very black and white. And I think, you know, the public lands and waters, no matter what kind of political background you come from, I hope and I kind of see that they are great unifiers.
That's an interesting topic too, because there are like lots of different mindsets coming into the outdoor world, essentially. Is it safe to say that the biggest demographics you pertain to are like hunters and fishermen, or do you also have other groups that are becoming members and providing lots of support for you guys?
Yeah, so we just did our second membership survey. We've done it 2 years in a row now, and it came back, you know, that we're 98% of us hunting fish, and there's a 2% that's like other, right, that uses the outdoors in a different way. Mm-hmm. And so that's our membership. You know, I think that, you know, that said, like, you know, we're not looking at our toes and saying we're only going to talk to hunters and anglers. I think it's very important, you know, as more and more users get out there, is that we have open dialogue with them. I think finding common ground is a really important thing. And when you find that common ground, it makes those, you know, things that you disagree on much easier to talk about. And so hopefully you can find a, you know, an easier solution. But, you know, our membership, we're straight hunters and anglers. And I think Stephen Ranella, you know, the meat eater, said once, like, this is the most hunting and fishing people I've ever been around. And like, I say that, you know, we have, you know, again, people that are starting to be new hunters, but really our folks are people that, you know, this is not, you know, a pastime or something, a hobby. It's like a way of life for them.
Right. Yeah. That's what the passion is. I'm wondering if you can just expand on that a little bit more, because I'm hoping to glean a little bit of information from it, in the sense of like, you're there representing hunters and anglers, and you've spoken to how you need to find kind of that common ground between those other groups. But are there examples or tips or kind of ways of working that you could share? Because you are going to see competing interests at the table when you're talking about public lands, right? So how do you negotiate around that, and how do you support each other at the end of the day?
Yeah, so I think I'd say a couple things. And, you know, as our... I think membership grows up in Canada. Like, I think, you know, I'll have better ways to talk to you about this.
For sure.
And I have examples, but the majority of these are going to be, you know, state driven. And I think the first one is like going back to that membership survey and, you know, that we just did, is that, you know, while there's a bunch of outliers on Canadian, because you guys have so many darn different, political parties, but, there's like, came back 33% independent and 26% Republican, 16% Democrat, and the rest were kind of you know, people that didn't disclose or something else. And to me, like, that's a good reflection of how, and that's, it's not quite cut in thirds, but it's close and it's pretty diverse. And like, to me, I just see that as like public lands are bringing people together, right? And so that's a beautiful thing to me. And sometimes, it can be challenging as well. But I'd rather stay on the beautiful side of kind of finding that common ground.
Right. So your solution here is to really just double down on what unifies us and what's our common interest, and let's build on that. And we'll figure out the other stuff in the details.
Yeah, and I think, all three of us are sitting here talking on the phone, and, we might agree on a lot of things, but we probably disagree on other things too. And I before we start talking about stuff that's going to divide us potentially, let's talk about the stuff that unifies us. And
absolutely.
And to me, I think differences of opinion is okay. If we were 100% lockstep, all three of us, that'd be a pretty boring world and pretty boring conversation. Right? I think that, like, having things that challenge the way you think, I think, is a really important thing. And as long as that those things that bind you are strong enough, you'll stay together and I think make things better.
And that ultimately will make a stronger organization or stronger group also too, because you have different mindsets coming in from different aspects and different ideas being tossed around, and that way you can be, I feel like, more prepared almost for something that could potentially be coming down the pipe that me or Tristan might not know about, but you have full knowledge about something completely different, essentially, if that makes any sense to you.
Oh, it totally does. I mean, I think having different angles always makes you better, right? Like, when there's blind spots that you might not know about, or there's nuances, and I think those are all important things. And I think it's, so there's kind of like, I think, again, just a little bit of the nature of who we are. And then you go into practice, and I would talk about, I'm trying to think how to like talk to you about this. I think I'll go big and maybe I'll go small. So, there was a public lands package that got passed this last year down in the States, and, it was voted on 92-8 in the Senate and 363-62 in the House. And if you're watching our politics, at all down here, like, two parties don't agree on anything really ever. And they never vote on things together. And what happened with that vote is people came together, and it was, 700 pages about public lands and public waters. And, within that, everybody kind of had a piece of, something that they wanted out of that was for their, particular state. But what also happened, there was a thing called the Land and Water Conservation Fund, and that was, something that is the, best access tool and kind of large scale conservation tool that we have in this country. And it had sunset that last September, so about a year ago now. And so, there was a bunch of pressure from the grassroots to make sure that program was carried forward again in perpetuity. So that pressure from the outside, I think, besides kind of nature of public lands that brings people together, I think it was that pressure from the outside that ultimately, from all sorts of people from different backgrounds, ultimately got that big win. And so, that is one, that, again, it's a huge one. I'm super excited about it. And, one that I think that, we should all be proud of and celebrate.
So it sounds here like, I don't want to be too romantic about it, but it really sounds to me like good old Teddy Roosevelt's vision here has been almost this unifying voice in a very like polarized American political context. Roosevelt's, I know he's a kind of a role model for you in a lot of ways, has cut through the smoke here to kind of deliver a unifying message. Is that accurate?
Yeah, I think that's accurate. I mean, I think that I'm not gonna be all, the glass is totally completely full and overflowing. I think there's detractors for sure. Mm-hmm. But I think in this situation, people came together, and I mean, you talk about, Roosevelt and
you know, there's many others, you know, Hornaday. I mean, it's like the list kind of goes on. But there's countless other people, you know, that were there as well that we don't know the names of. And so, like, this little game, and this is, like, something I usually end with, but this little thing that we're, you know, kind of experiencing in North America is a very kind of new experiment. You know, we're talking 150, maybe 175 years old. You really start looking about how it's all set up. And to me, like, you know, they gifted it to us, and, like, right now it's cutting through that. But, you know, so, you know. In 2 decades, if my daughter is done, you know, what I'm doing today, she'll be having the same conversation that we're having right now, you know, like trying to find common ground. You know, there's some threats that are out there, absolutely, and, you know, there always will be. And so, like, to me, it's not all, I mean, I don't want to paint too rosy of a picture because there are, you know, things that are happening that are discouraging.
Yeah.
But in this case, it was a place, you know, again, for people to come together who, as of late, really have not been doing it.
Yeah, so one thing I kind of took away from that, what you just said there, is the fact that your daughter, you're hoping that your daughter will kind of be in the same position, and she essentially is going to be advocating for the outdoors also at the same time. And I may butcher this, but I think I heard this on a Ranella podcast, and he said something along the lines of, like, it's not our job or our particular issue, it's just our turn to essentially take the torch and run with this and take care of our ecosystems.
As stewards. Yeah, I mean, it's like, I would say it like, you know, none of this happened by accident, right? And now is our time to do our part, you know? But then, you know, it's not going to get carried forward by accident, whether that's right now or in a decade or in 2 decades, 100 years from now, right? This thing that we have that is unique in the entire world, like, that is not just hanging out there without folks that want to take it for themselves. And whether that's to exploit it or to, you know, have their own little kind of slice of heaven. You know, it's always been there. It's always going to be there. And that's just something we need to be comfortable with. And that's why I love being in the arena.
Yeah, for sure. But so let me put it to you this way, Landa. So in Canada here, we'll shift to Canada. 41% of our total land base is federal crown land, meaning like public. We have a bit of a different system, as you alluded to earlier, because we came from that British monarchy and we didn't separate for a little while compared to you down south. On top of that, 48% of it is provincially owned crown land. So that totals up to like 89% public lands across Canada. Manitoba, we're even better. We're at 90% public land ownership. But yet, backcountry hunters and anglers is in Alberta. It's in BC. It's in the Yukon. Like these very wild places. Like, what are you doing there? What's the reason for that?
Sure. So I'll you know, again, refer back to what I said earlier. Is like we kind of go where noise is, right? And so in our beginning in Canada, really, you know, I don't want to put it all on one individual because there was others that helped, but, you know, Bill Hanlon out of British Columbia, out of Cranbrook, was really the catalyst to, like, starting kind of our Canadian presence. And he was an early adopter, you know, really of kind of backcountry hunters and anglers and just kind of, you know, what we were espousing. I don't know if you guys know this story, but he found the Iceman up in northern BC when he's on a sheep hunt. This guy that was like emerging from a glacier that was 500 years old and like just absolutely crazy story. If you don't know that story, I'll send you a link to it. It is freaking amazing.
We can put it in the notes of our podcast and see.
Get on it. Like it's one of the most, like he tells a story that's like 2 hours long that you're in rapture the entire time. So it's like one of these things and I won't give you the punchline. But there's something that happens when he comes back a couple years later that will blow your mind.
No way. Okay. Okay. That's a good setup. Like that's a good setup.
When anybody listen to this, go look at that. I could give details, but I'm not going to because I think it's so rad. So Bill is really the catalyst of that, you know, and I think, you know, from that, it's more about, and it was kind of like, about managing travel management up there on Crown lands and then like resource management. And I think, you know, being engaged in the process that's similar to what we have here in the States, but a little different, you know, and having a voice and amplifying, you know, his voice and some of the things that he was seeing I would say in particular, in timber harvest in British Columbia. And then you get into kind of more oil and gas development, in both places, you know, illegal ATV use. I think that was a huge concern, you know, as, Canadian members, some of them use ATVs and there's definitely a place for them, you know, especially where they're legally allowed. It's just like anything, you know, people start breaking the rules and that hurts everybody. And so I think illegal ATV use has been a big one. It's kind of been unifying. And so, you know, as I think British Columbia is kind of the anchor, then Alberta came on about 3 years later. And then just this last year, you know, the Yukon came on. And I think, you know, as you described, very wild places, but, you know, none of that happened because, you know, we were like, hey, let's start something up in British Columbia, or like, let's go to Alberta now, or, you know, Yukon. I mean, I remember Yukon, you know, we had to make an exception. We have sent us kind of some rules and some plateaus that people need to reach before they become a chapter. And one of those is like having 200 members in your state or province. And Yukon was like, man, 200 of like, you know, like places with big populations is not that big of a deal, but for us, you know, like,
yeah,
30,000 people. And so, like, and so they banged on the door, you know, we kind of initially said, no, like, you're not ready. And they banged on the door and that's why that happened. And
that's awesome.
I think, you know, that piece is really, you know, I think, again, like, we did that because of them, and, you know, now they're looking at, again, like, similar things up there, you know, travel management and resource allocation. So, you know, that part of, you know, what we do, again, like, we're not, I think there's this big fear that I hear sometimes from, you know, people that maybe look at us sideways, especially up in Canada, is like, hey, this is an American organization telling Canada what to do. And that couldn't be farther from the truth. You know, I've never called anybody up in Canada and said, hey, there's this thing going on, you shall do this. It's more about them saying, hey, this is going on, can you help us amplify our voice?
Right. And, so, you know, you're providing capacity for really what are grassroots organizations.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So that's that kind of, like, you know, added to the megaphone or expertise on things that have worked for us down here. That's kind of, you know, I think, you know, besides, you know, staff having that conversation, this is also, you know, the ability to kind of hook volunteer leaders up with each other and say, this is what's worked for us, you know, and this is what, you know, has worked for us, like, you know, on either side of the border. And, you know, there's simple things. I think part of this is like education about kind of having some of these wild places. And again, I think, you know, the way public lands, I think the beauty of them is that, you know, there's different uses. And it happened in different places, but, you know, that also doesn't mean that, you know, all uses everywhere all the time. And I think that's something that translates on both sides. And to me, that's really the genesis, I would say, of the Canadian kind of chapters.
So this is definitely going to be a bit of a loaded question or a two-parted question. Yeah. I'm just wondering, like, because we don't have a chapter here in Manitoba, Panoramic listeners, in case you're not aware. We don't have a backcountry hunter and angler chapter. But we have a long history of, like, mobilized environment and hunter and fishing activists with a lot of knowledge. I'm just wondering, like, what kind of threats should we be on the lookout for? Like, what are some of these factors that people have mobilized around? You mentioned, like, some travel management, oil and gas development. Like, what are the issues that people are coming to you with saying, hey, we need help raising our voices on this?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's identifying, I think, special places is probably the first thing. And really trying to keep things the way they are. You know, we're not, you know, we're not making really any more blank spots on the map anymore, you know, and I think that you all are, you know, blessed with an abundance of public land, but there's, you know, these places that are, you know, super important for our hunting and fishing traditions, but also for fishing wildlife habitat, that are places that, you know, should be, I think, cherished and, you know, protected to keep them exactly the way they are right now.
Yeah.
So, like, finding those places, you know, and you know, when I talk about resource management plans, I mean, that's really a lot of the time, you know, or travel management plans, is like that dictates how those kind of landscapes are going to be utilized. And so, you know, paying attention to kind of, you know, what is happening. And again, you know, I'll speak to you know, stuff down here in the States. But, you know, as more and more technology and, you know, like electric bikes and, you know, all sorts of different ways of using our wood start to happen, like when and where those things happen, I think is going to be important, not only to the hunting and fishing experience, but also the way wildlife uses it, right? Mm-hmm. You know, when I think about e-bikes in particular, you know, I think that, you know, we have a ton of members that use them. And, you know, there's changes happening right now on public lands down here in the States about where these e-bikes can be used. And so, you know, they're starting to be considered more like bikes than, you know, motors. And so you're getting more and more people into places they haven't been, which is starting to displace, you know, big game in particular. So mule deer, and, you know, that have that high country as well as elk. And so that's something that we're concerned about and that, you know, we want to have a conversation about and look at the landscape and figure out where those things are best used. And, you know, when I say that to you, I don't want any you guys or anybody listening to this to think that, they, you know, PHA hates e-bikes. It's not that way. We just want to make sure that, you know, what's best for the landscape is out there and that conversation is happening. So that's an example, I guess I would say, of like, you know, kind of maybe some travel management stuff that also includes, you know, ATVs as well.
Right, right. And that kind of brings you back to your point you were making earlier about getting different demographic groups to agree on similar conservation strategies and just bringing people together essentially to manage wildlife is what it comes down to and keep everyone happy that is in support.
Absolutely. And I'll give you an example that's just south of the border. So Blackfoot Valley, which is just east of Missoula here. There's, you know, you're on the southern end of the Bob Marshall Wilderness, very storied wilderness, about 1.1 million acres. And so on the bottom side of that is some public land that kind of management has been up in the air for a while. That's ruled this area. There's been some illegal activity, whether that's mountain biking or snowmobiling that's in there. You have timber companies that want to harvest more timber. And then you have, you know, folks that want to keep it the way it is right now. And so after a decade of kind of conversations, and I think, you know, very hard conversations over kitchen tables and coffees and, you know, in meetings, they come up with this compromise. They call it the Blackfoot Clearwater Stewardship Act. And it's like this compromise that, you know, not everybody gets exactly what they want, but they get a path forward. And so in this case, you know, there's going to be snowmobile areas established in roadless areas where they have the least impact on kind of the wildlife species there during the winter. You're going to have a long mountain bike trail kind of on the outside of the wilderness area. And they're going to have, like, I think 70,000 acres of new wilderness is going to be added to the Bob Marshall. And then the timber companies, you know, they're supporting this. They don't really get much out of this one, but it's been a compromise on some timber sales that were elsewhere where, you know, those projects went forward. And so everybody is getting something. And, you know, I think when this bill was released or introduced just like a month ago, there was a bunch of people that got up and spoke, and one of them was the guy that was with timber, and he's like, you know, I'm not getting anything out of this deal. You all have been there for me on these other places. By God, I'm going to stand up for new wilderness. And, you know, for a timber dude to say that in front of a big crowd with news cameras all around, like that one, I'm very proud of his leadership there. But two, it shows you like that compromise is possible, and it's a path forward on our public lands. And I think that story hopefully can translate north of the border as well.
That's wicked. So maybe if I could lay out to you my understanding or our understanding of the Manitoba context here, and maybe you could reflect back with a backcountry lens.
Yep.
You know, like some opportunities or some kind of those thoughts there. Sure. So like the context, as far as I can tell in Manitoba here, is like some of the red flags we're looking at is I think all hunters and anglers are kind of, you know, we recognize we're blessed with a lot of accessible land, but we're concerned about the resource management side of things, and to the point where the province is now trying to take a leadership role in shared management plans, they're called, which is essentially trying to like negotiate a management plan between hunters and anglers, the right-based harvesters. So like I should say licensed hunters and anglers, rights-based harvesters, which come from our constitutional treaties. And then also like you have other interest groups in there as well, as you've identified, like resource harvesting groups like timber and that. On the other side of things, there are some land access things cropping up as well, which is recently the government's tabled the Crown Lands Disposition Act, and like we don't have any real details on it, but it doesn't sound good at the moment, or at least it's, you know, it there's an ominous tone to it. So
yeah, there's definitely been a lot of people that are quite concerned about this. I think back in the 80s, the government did this gigantic land sale. A few things that trickled down through one of the conservation organizations here, the Manitoba Wildlife Federation, and they've kind of said from the politicians have told them that this isn't going to affect the outdoors group that much or at all. We certainly haven't seen anything in writing yet, but I mean, everything's still kind of up in the air. So
yeah, we just haven't seen a lot about it. The title just doesn't sound good, so we're concerned about it. The hunters and anglers, I think, are concerned about. So, like, do you think there's capacity there for backcountry to, you know, add value to what we're trying to achieve in Manitoba, and like with that lens?
Yeah, I mean, so I think like the shared management plans, like. You know, for me, like if you're not at the table, you're on the menu, right? Like you have to be part of those conversations. And as those things, you know, again, they dictate kind of how things happen on that landscape. I think you have to be at that table. And so, you know, one of the most important things, I think, to elevate that voice, which has been done, you know, by two of your fellow provinces is becoming a chapter, right? I think like individually, it's much harder for us to do. I think the individually piece, you know, I think we could hook you up with some of our, you know, other, you know, chapter leadership in those other two provinces and then up in the Yukon and try to figure out like the best way to engage like as an individual in that process. But having a chapter, like it just elevates that voice like very quickly. And so I think, like when I think about that piece in particular, and I think that's an important thing. And I could talk to you. I mean, we could definitely, you know, talked about how to make technical comments and how to show up to meetings. And I think showing up is a really important thing. And just, you know, talking about kind of your interests, anybody can do that and they should do that. But as far as like, I think direction, you know, that would definitely come from, you know, some of our chapter leaders before you guys all have a chapter, if that's something that you ever do. On the other piece, you know, on the disposition,
yeah,
I mean, that does sound horrible from the onset. You know, we had a gentleman named Mr. Chaffetz, congressman from Utah, who, you know, proposed to sell 3 million acres down here in the States, and we got that shut down in about a week. And so, I guess I'd like to know more details about that, and like, you know, what is actually at stake, kind of what some of the
so would we.
I don't know if this is kind of like a bone they're tossing us, but one thing they kind of mentioned was like most of the properties they're looking at selling are mostly like old highways, yards, and stuff like that. But I mean, they certainly haven't gone into any details. So I think like we're still waiting. And I know the Manitoba Wildlife Federation does quite a bit of advocating on that front, and they're still kind of grinding away to get more details on the entire story also. But there's definitely some shaking people.
I got a bridge I can sell you tomorrow too. I mean, I think I very trust exactly what's coming out of people's face or miles until you hear kind of what it looks like on paper. I think when it comes to those things, right? And I think I'm glad that, you know, the Manitoba Wildlife Federation is up there and they're keeping track of us. And like, I think, you know, we would be, you know, brothers and sisters in arms, you know, if we ever had a chapter up there.
For sure. So I'm going to go out on a limb here and say that your advice would be to be stay vigilant and be honest about what's actually happening here.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. And I think that vigilance is such an important thing. You know, when these things get sold, that's the end of the line, right? You know, you hardly ever get them back. You know, there's a couple examples down here where we've been successful doing that, but the majority of that is that you don't get that back. And so I think stay vigilant, you know, be prepared to look at details. And, you know, I think that, you know, use your voice. You know, I think that whether that's at public meetings or through a process, just make sure you're using your voice.
Yeah. Awesome. Well, I think we want to be respectful of your time here, Lan, because I think you did mention that there's a parameters, but I didn't want to let you get off the line here without telling us a hunting or fishing story. And like, kind of like what, because I've seen you talk and that really seems to be your connection and your passion to what you do. And I got to hear one from you. I've seen you talk.
We've spoken about the campfire.
Yeah.
We've got the proverbial campfire going here.
I'll even strike up a match if we need to.
All right. Well, you're catching me on the spot. What am I going to tell you? Let me see. There's a few that I've told quite a bit. I'll tell you one that I really haven't told for a long time. I've got a best friend since fourth grade. We've done a lot of hunting and fishing together. We've gotten a lot of trouble together. You know, we've known each other for that long. You operate, as a team, maybe a dysfunctional team, but you always get stuff done. And so, this story is a little bit about that. And so it's late season down in Montana. We used to have a late season kind of elk hunt. There's still some of that that goes on. We're outside of, you know, a spot that we've hunted before, know it fairly well. It's the morning of kind of opening day, and there's about 2 feet of snow, and it's snowing, and we decide that we're not going to like bust up to the spot like in the morning. We want to glass and make sure if we see elk, you know, that's what we're pursuing. Like let's make a move on them. And so morning kind of clears, we get to see these elk up on the hill, and we're like, let's go do it. And so we trudge up this hill. It's super steep. It's probably about 2,000 feet of elevation. We're about ready to get into where we need to be. And this is public land, and we run into another set of hunters. And so we're a little defeated. And like, well, what should we do? And we kind of were like, well, you guys go ahead. And so it's a dad and like two young kids. And so we let them go, and we go back down the hill, and we're kind of sitting in the truck having lunch. We look back up on the hill, and those elk are in the exact same spot. And this is like 2 hours later, and they have not made a move on them. And I don't think they ever even saw them. That was something we never discussed. And so we were literally within like a quarter mile of these elk over the top of this ridge, and we didn't talk about it. And so we decided it's time to go back up there. So we're trudging up the hill, and my buddy's behind me, and we're kind of excited, and I'm moving fairly fast in this deep snow. And my foot slips, and I hit my buddy in the mouth, knock him over, almost knock him out. And he's got a bloody nose, bloody mouth. And I'm like, oh, my God, this is over. And he looks at me, and I'm like, dude, I'm so sorry. He's like, don't be sorry. We're going to go get those elk. Okay. And so we continue up this ridge, and it's a steep cliff faces. And we're looking for these elk. We find where they've been. I don't know if they heard me kick my buddy in the mouth and moved, or they just moved for the day. But we're looking at these cliffs, and we're like, man, how are we going to get through these things? And we're just like, let's just follow the elk. We start following the elk. Well, they obviously know that country way better than we do. They find this little slippy kind of spot through the cliffs. We follow them into this kind of bigger basin that just has tons of rolling hills. And so we spend some time in there, and then we finally locate the herd. And I've got a cow tag, and these elk wind us, and they're running down this ridge. And my buddy's like, let's go find them. And so we run down this ridge, and he's breathing. And he's like, we're pretty young. And he's like, now put your gun on my back. And like, let's just shoot one of these. And my gun's going up and down with his breath, right? Like he's breathing in and out. And I've just been running down this thing. And there's lots of elk around. And it's like, I have a cow tag. There's, you know, young bull, spike. And then there's this cow. And I shoot her. Like, I don't know. I mean, it's the, how that all happened in this window. And I shoot her, and we sit down, and we wait a while, and it starts to snow again. And we go find this cow, and as we're sitting there, it's kind of like, it's one of those things, like, we gave up almost, you know, could have given up a couple times that day, and we didn't. And I think people have those kind of stories all over the place. It's a very common one that isn't, I don't think, doesn't have any big ups or big downs, but it just, that's one. But man, it was awesome day, and you know, to have somebody that you trust in the woods, to have those opportunities to kind of fail or you know, have the opportunities to give up, but then persevere. Like, hopefully we all have those conversations, and that's really what we're trying to do, you know, here at BHA, is make sure that, you know, we got places to climb mountains and kick our friends in the face.
That really sounds like it ties together nicely. In some ways, the essence of what we've talked about today. You know, you met other hunters on the trail. You kind of negotiated a plan of action collectively forward. Encountered a little resistance. Maybe even had to kick someone in the face. but at the end of the day, you got what you needed to get done. You had to slip through a canyon and shoot off your buddy's back, but you did it.
Minus the mountain, I feel like that's could be a very similar set of events told at one of our campfires.
Oh yeah, a little tomfoolery.
Yeah, definitely.
Well, and I like just. Want to thank you so much for coming on the podcast and like sharing your knowledge and sharing, you know, your success stories here around what it means to be an activist and an advocate for public lands. I think we're in some ways we're all kind of cut from the same cloth in that way, but also just your deep appreciation for like how each region has its own specific issues and it needs to be from the grassroots was like just really inspiring as well.
Good. Well, I enjoy the conversation. And, you know, I guess my parting thought is just, you know, no matter what kind of, you know, background you come from and, you know, how you care about, you know, your crown lands, like use your voice, right? Like use your voice because I think you gotta be at the table. And, you know, I think, that's why we have what we have today, and that's how we're going to have it moving forward. So we'll be part of that solution versus a pitch on the sidelines.
Awesome. Thanks again, Lad.
Well, thank you guys. This is awesome. Yeah.